Hi, I'm Mary Wilson. This is September 28, 2020, and I am interviewing Bonnie Howe, a local minister. Bonnie, would you like to introduce yourself and your congregation a little bit before we proceed?
Hi, I'm Bonnie Howe. I am a transplanted Canadian, lived in Canada for most of my life, and then came to the United States, to Texas specifically, 14 years ago. I am the senior pastor, the solo pastor of St. Luke United Methodist Church in historic Old West Austin, right on the edge of Clarksville. We characterize ourselves as United Methodist, but radically inclusive. So we're open and affirming and really justice-minded. And so it's a good place to be. I've served here for the last year, and it's been great. It's been a good thing.
Has it just been a year?
Yeah, July
yeah,
of
okay.
2019.
For some reason, I was thinking it had been longer than that.
No,
yeah. Where were you before that?
I served at Cedar Park, First United Methodist, and I was there
okay.
for a long time as the associate. And prior to being the associate, I was the youth director. So 10 years or so.
So we first met when you were at the church in Cedar Park.
Cedar Park.
And
mm-hmm.
I was at a church in Cedar Park.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. My timeline was a little off, but
yeah.
Be that as it may. So I want to start by asking a kind of an obvious question. What brought you to the United States from Canada?
My husband's work. He's in video game design, and his company was working on a Star Wars game. And they wanted to have easier access to LucasArts and all that sort of thing. And so they decided to open a studio in Austin. Their main headquarters are in Edmonton, Alberta. Sorry, I thought I had turned that ringer off. Their main headquarters are in Edmonton, Alberta, and Edmonton and Austin are actually very similar cities culturally, rather than, you know, comparing Houston to Calgary. They're all very business and oil and gas mm-hmm. and money, money, money. Whereas Edmonton and Austin are the capitals of their state or province. They're arts and culture oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of have that similar bent to them. So Austin was a good place for the company to set up their U.S. branch. And so we got transferred okay. down here. And it was really hard for me. My undergrad is in Canadian Studies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my family came down here to buy a house. And my dad called me on the Saturday when we were starting house hunting, crying and upset, and told me I was a traitor to my country and my family for considering
oh, no.
moving to the U.S. And I have felt that way all this time. So I became a citizen this May, solely so I could participate, because I had been disenfranchised for all this time.
Sure.
And it was a big, yeah. I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried when I did my oath. But
wow.
Thankfully, I had my mask because it was
yeah.
COVID. So
you became a citizen of the United States in the middle of a pandemic
mm-hmm.
with a background message that somehow you were betraying Canada by doing
yeah.
so. How are yeah. you then?
Yeah, my mom, you know, because the biggest reason I did that was so that I could vote. And my mom just even sent me a text this weekend saying, did you vote? Because she knows early voting is starting in places. And
yeah.
And her questions was her, she had two parts to her question. Did you vote? When are you moving home?
Oh. And where is home?
In Alberta, in Southern Alberta, in the Rocky okay. Mountains. I grew up about 45 minutes from Glacier National Park.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So really beautiful. Place.
I can't even imagine. That
yeah.
sounds lovely.
It is lovely.
So do you think you will ever move back?
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't think so. Because we have three grown children who've made their life here.
Yeah.
One of them has become a citizen. One is actually doing his citizenship interview next week.
Okay.
And we have a daughter who is not ready to do that yet, just because
yeah.
she doesn't like the idea of a particular signature being on her documents yet.
Got it.
You would rather wait. But they're here and they make their life here. One of our kids is married, and so, yeah.
So this is your new home. Yeah.
This is it. This is it.
So were you a pastor before you came to Texas?
I did. I served a church in Edmonton called Mill Creek Church of God. It was out of the denomination of the Church of God of Anderson, Indiana. So a Wesleyan, mm-hmm. a Wesleyan bent, but really small denomination. Mm-hmm. And I was the pastor to youth. And there were three pastors. There was the senior pastor, and then the pastor to the German congregation, because we had it was a German background church, and they had a service still that was in German.
Oh, wow.
And so he was the pastor to the German congregation, and then me as the youth minister.
Yeah.
And I was in seminary in Canada, and we transferred as I was in seminary. And so I had to do seminary here again. And find a church, because that denomination didn't have a congregation here that I could find. They do now. But I had to find a denomination and didn't really know much about the denominations here, except for, some that I walked into that didn't have women in leadership. And,
right, right. Yeah. And so the Wesleyan tradition of the Methodist Church was more natural fit than the others.
It was a great fit for me. It connects to my theology in a really good way. The issue around LGBTQ issues and acceptance has been difficult for me, so it remains difficult.
What I know superficially about your congregation is it has been one of the more outspoken ones in supporting LGBTQ people, in not just in the city, but I think in Methodist world. So how has that worked for you, feeling like you have this home theologically that feels good, and yet there's this other place of, in the Methodist Church, pretty big conflict.
For me, there's been a lot of grace in being able to say, if God calls me out of this place, then God calls me out of this place. And so there's that part of it, and then there's also this aspect of hope that if you stay in it and stay advocating for this act of justice, which I think it is an act of justice to raise your voice and say, no, people are beloved, and that this is not an issue of choice or, you know, whatever people say about it. It's not what we should be thinking about, or the perspective that we need to be talking about queer issues in. So trying to stay in that conversation, has been important, exhausting sometimes, but important. And I know that my own social location in the issue is so privileged, you know, compared to, like, we have somebody in our midst, in our congregation, who is moving forward, is in seminary right now, is moving forward in our candidacy process, which is our process to become a pastor, who is openly in a relationship, is queer, and to walk with them as they are saying, this is my calling, and I have to move forward in this, even knowing the potential for harm in that, because we aren't there yet, and to counsel them and being, you know, saying, I see God's calling in you, and for our congregation to say, we see God's calling in you, and we are going to do everything we can to affirm you in this calling and to support you and love you. I mean, that is a social location of privilege that we need to use to advance this issue.
Yeah. Well, let me back up a little bit to earlier in your life and maybe events along the way, what are some of the formative experiences you've had that I would say has led you to be the person you are today, and in particular led you into being a pastor? What's your story?
My story is unique and interesting, I've been told. I did not grow up in a church. I'd never went to church as a kid. And there was a couple things that happened when I was in university. One was that I was in I took a lot of Canadian literature classes. Mm-hmm. And the conversations always came back to, well, this reminds me of so-and-so in the Bible, or this is a retelling of the story of Ruth or whatnot. But I didn't have any of that language because I'd never gone to church. Right. And I am an Enneagram 2 with one wings, which means I'm a perfectionist. I'm a helper with perfectionist bent. And the fact that I didn't have any of that language drove me nuts. And so I started asking people, I need to figure this out. Tell me about this. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, another part of my undergrad had a lot to do with First Nation studies, or at the time it was called Native American studies. That's a large portion of what my undergrad consisted of. And so I was in classes with people from the Blackfoot and Pekani and Blood tribes, which are the tribes around the area where I grew up. And they had a worldview and a view of the creator that really impacted me. So those two things kind of collided to, you know, in the Wesleyan tradition, and this is why the Wesleyan tradition appeals to me so much, we have this notion of prevenient grace, which is the grace of God that goes before you. And it's as if we are created to be in relationship with God, and God is constantly wooing you before you know anything about God or before you have any language for that. So that was happening in my life. And then I had opportunities to say, tell me about your faith, tell me about your faith, tell me about your faith. Mm-hmm. And everybody just told me about how their church was the best and I shouldn't go down the street to that other church because it was terrible. And so I was really frustrated with that. And then I had an experience, one of these very mystical experiences where God spoke to me and said that I was beloved and spoke words to me in a really weirdly audible way. And that experience, my first reaction was not, I'm going crazy, but that was God.
Yeah.
110% certain that that was the Holy Spirit and that that was God. And I wouldn't have been able to say that was the Holy Spirit because I didn't know anything about that, but to be able to say that was God.
Yeah.
And so recognizing that there is a reality of God in our midst and the presence of God shifted my quest to figure out now what. Like, I believe God exists and that should impact every aspect of my life. Because that's how I saw Native American people living their faith. They have a faith in the creator that impacts how they live. And I felt like once you come to that reality that God is, mm-hmm. so it should impact you completely. And it did. It shifted my whole way of being, mm-hmm. which scared my husband. Like, he was terrified. I was already married. I married my high school sweetheart and he was not on the same journey and he had no idea what was going on. He thought I was nuts. But I knew that this was God and I need to figure this out. So I spent the next year and a half trying to figure out, like, does this mean I need to go to church? What does this mean? I have no idea. Yeah. And we moved from Southern Alberta to Ottawa so that my husband could go to school. And all those times that I was asking people in Alberta, tell me about your faith, tell me about your faith. And they would tell me about their church. Not one person invited me.
How interesting.
Yeah. And so we moved to Ottawa and the Saturday we arrived, we're unpacking our U-Haul. Our next door neighbor walked over and introduced herself and said, I'm going to check out a new church tomorrow. Do you want to come with me?
Wow.
And it was literally a 5-minute conversation of introduction and invitation. Mm-hmm. And we went, and she never went back.
Interesting.
And I kept going because after the service was over, she made a beeline for that pastor. And, you know, I don't know anything about this woman at all, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but her best friend had just died of cancer at the age of 23.
Oh.
And she was furious at God. And she just, why did this happen? Why couldn't I do anything to help her or save her? And the pastor said, well, what did you do? Which I was like, she's just telling you what you did. What did you do? And she goes, I stayed in her hospital room and we read stories to her and we played games and we cried and we laughed. And he said, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be present.
Yeah.
Jesus calls us to be present in the world. And for me, that was like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be present. Like God was present with me. Now I'm supposed to be present in the world.
Yeah.
As God is present with us. So that was it. I was baptized a few months later. And so that was in the Presbyterian church. And my elder, there was an elder who was kind of walking alongside me as I'm making this decision to be baptized. The night before my baptism, she took me to dinner and she said, are you excited about heaven? And I said, heaven? I haven't even given a thought to heaven. And she was appalled. And I said, why would I want to be worried about heaven when right here in this moment, I know God is with me.
Yeah.
And I know I am with God. Like for me, the relationship is present and real. The kingdom is here. And then I went home and went, oh my gosh, they're not going to let me get baptized tomorrow. I failed the test. But they did. So was all of that stuff, which is a long story, has shaped my leading and my calling because I don't think you come to this place, these four walls called church, to find God.
Mm-hmm.
I think it happens out there in the world through these people that are called Christians. This sounds judgmental to me when I say it, but we're supposed to be present in the world, embodying Christ, empowered by the Holy Spirit to be present in that same way. And I think we fall short. I do. I fall short all the time.
Yeah.
But that's the goal. That's sanctification. We're working towards being better at that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And that's also why I'm very ecumenical and interfaith, because I think God is out in the world revealing God's self to all people in all contexts, in all curious ways. And so to be really attentive and open and curious about that, to just be willing to see God in the world is really important.
So that's my... Just beautiful. Beautifully said. Thank you, Bonnie.
You're welcome.
So where is your husband on this journey with you now?
he was really terrified, honestly. He had no idea what that meant. And then when, you know, I started going to church in Ottawa, our kids were 1 and 3. Mm-hmm. And then I got pregnant with a third, but they were really little, and that church was meeting in a school gym or a rec center gymnasium, and they sat in a semicircle and kids just ran back and forth. And he decided that he was going to come with me to help me wrangle the kids.
Oh,
uh-huh. I was partly because he wanted to see what was happening and partly he wanted to help me out and be supportive. And 2.5 years later, we moved back to Alberta from Ontario and then Quebec. We lived in Quebec for a little bit and then we moved back to Alberta, and he decided that he wanted to go to this program called ALPHA. Are you familiar with ALPHA?
I've heard of it. I don't know the details of it, but I've heard of it.
It's basically Christianity 101. It goes through all the, and it's really low key. As a facilitator for Alpha, you're trained to say, that's really interesting. What do you think? And then you direct that thought to somebody else in the group. You never have the answers. You just are open to the questions and open to the leading of the spirit. And in Alpha, he had that kind of an aha moment. And he gave his life to Christ. But he also is not as passionate about it. I don't think it's as effective. You know, I don't think it's as effective with an A, affective. It hasn't changed him in that the same way that it just, you know, I don't think he had a mystical, you know, by definition, experience that kind of rocked his world the way I did. But yet, he is the first person to say to me when I'm talking about things in the life of the church, well, where is Jesus in that? And where's the gospel in that? Where's the good news in that? And where, how is that sharing Christ's love in the world? So
good questions, right?
Yeah, really good questions when we're thinking about doing this activity or that activity. So he is a person of faith too. Just it expresses it differently. And he's a different person. So it shouldn't be like that.
Right, right. Wow. I'm learning so much about you today that I'm very excited to be talking to you. I was wondering then, since you said that you didn't grow up going to church or have a religious background, what do your parents think about your vocation?
You know, and I'm going to say my family. My mom was 15 when she had me. My dad was 17. So they're really young. And we had a lot of support from our extended family. So when I think about my parents, it's just not my actual parents, but my grandparents and my aunt and uncles.
Yeah.
You know, like we're a big group of people because my parents needed support. And it was really tough at first. My uncle is gay. And he had a really hard time with that, with me becoming a Christian, because he had this notion that the church says that he's an abomination and that I should not have a relationship with him. But he and I are only 9 years apart, and we lived together. Before I got married, I rented from him while I was in university. And then when we did get married, we rented space from him in his house. Like we shared a house with him. And so he was really upset. And then it rippled throughout our family. And he didn't talk to me for a few years. Like we didn't have a relationship, and that was hard. And as much as I tried to tell him, you know, that's not all Christians and that's not my belief, it was really hard. Exacerbated by 9/11, actually, because when 9/11 happened, my sister-in-law was living in Manhattan, and when I watched the towers fall, I turned around to my husband and my kids and said, we're not doing Halloween this year. There's too much evil in the world. And then my kids said at a gathering that he was at, we're not doing Halloween this year because Mom said it's evil. And then he was like, well, if Mom's going to tell you can't do Halloween because it's evil, what is Mom telling you about me? And I was just heartbroken about 9/11 and just the devastation. So, so that was really hard. And concerned about our friend. We had friends in Montreal who were Muslim, and concerned about them. And it just was going crazy. The world was going crazy at that time. And I just didn't want to participate in that Halloween. It didn't seem fun to me. My parents are not Christians. My mom watches my online worship services sometimes, and my dad's been to church a couple times when he's visited with me. And he's proud of me when he sees me doing church. but it doesn't, I don't know, it hasn't impacted them in a big way.
Do they find it just astonishing that this is the path your life has taken?
I think so.
Surprising or?
I think so. I think surprising, perhaps a little bit disappointing, because I was on the Canadian constitutional lawyer track. Like that was where I was heading, was law school, and then I didn't because I had kids and wanted to have kids and wanted to have a family. So, but I was, when I think back, I was the first person in my family to go to university, like in my whole family. So they had high hopes for me.
And here you are in Austin, Texas.
Here I am, a traitor to my country and a pastor and not a lawyer. And yeah, but
Well, how do you deal with that language of traitor? I mean, how do you care for yourself emotionally with that resonating in your mind?
I don't think I have processed that.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, because I actually believe it.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's like that is for me. A couple of years ago, before I became a citizen, I went with some friends to New York City, and I'd been to New York City before, but I hadn't been to Ellis Island. And there's this whole exhibit about what it means to be a citizen, and there's the oath on the wall. And it says in the oath that you renounce your country. And that was just like, just even, it was interesting. If there was a year to become a citizen, this was the good year, because when I went to my citizenship oath, we were only like 10 people in this room that sat 150 people, and you weren't allowed to bring guests, and you weren't allowed to sit. Like my husband and I were at the same ceremony, but I couldn't sit with him. We had to sit apart. We had our masks on, and then the person at the front, rather than saying, repeat after me or anything like that, he said, I am going to say the oath, and then you say, I do. And that made it easier for me because I didn't say those words. I didn't say, I renounce my country. And it was so crazy because it literally, our appointment was at 10 a.m., and by 10:04, we were back at our vehicle.
Wow,
We
that is
sat
fast.
down. He told us what was going to happen. We stood up. He said the oath. We said, I do. He said, pick up your certificate on your way out. And we were out.
Wow.
So that, it made it, it was a little bit more palatable because I didn't speak those words.
Sure.
But at the same time, I said, I do. So that was hard.
Well, I'm wondering how this impacts your vocation as a pastor. Where do you think that helps or hurts you? Where are you surprised by that experience influencing you as a minister?
It helps me in that I see the justice issues around immigration in a little bit different way. Because I know as an immigrant, even an immigrant with the social location and privilege of being white and having a college education, I know how hard it is to navigate this system. The system in the United States is not user-friendly at all. Even from something as simple as trying to get her driver's license when she turned 16. It was a bureaucratic mess and it was just horrible. And I could not imagine what that would have been like had we had to go through that system where English wasn't our first language and we did not know how to, we didn't have the education that would enable us to more easily read all the legalese and the, there's so much rules and regulations and this and that. And we even missed things. Well, not, it wasn't in there, but We had gone through all the documentation with a fine-tooth comb, only to be told that she couldn't get her driver's license yet or her learner's permit because her passport was not going to be valid for more than 90 days. Her Canadian passport was expiring in like 72 days. And so they wouldn't let her move forward. But to get a new passport meant we had to send her original one back to Canada and apply. And it was taking 12 weeks at that time because of everybody needed, it was that point where everybody was needing to get a passport.
Yeah.
But so having to navigate this bureaucratic machine, even with those advantages and still having problems, it's eye-opening to me.
Yeah.
So I feel like that has given me a bent more towards justice in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
The way it's negatively impacted me, there's an author that I love, this piece he wrote. His name is Russell Scott Sanders, I think is his name. But he writes about what it means to be woven into a community. So that you know the rocks and the politicians and the wildflowers, you know the names of all those things. But because I have this deep longing for home, I haven't allowed myself to do that. And I think I kept my kids from being able to fully do that. Certainly my daughter has that longing for home, and home is not here. Home is there. And so not being able to be at home is a negative impact from all of that stuff.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds really challenging.
Yeah.
I'm also thinking about the fact that you've been at St. Luke's for a year as a senior pastor, and halfway through that year, it came the pandemic. How is that? Tell me how life is as a minister in the midst of a pandemic and what your church is doing and how you all are navigating this.
My husband laughs at me because I am really struggling with it because I am a people person. I would much rather do this meeting in person. And I love sitting out I live in the parsonage, so on the property, and we put in a patio out front so I could sit and visit with neighbors and people, and to not be able to do that has been really hard. And to not be able to invite, come to church on Sunday, to not be able to do that has been really hard. To say, you should check us out on Zoom or on Facebook. This feels really lame to me. I mean, it just does.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
And to not have church members around has made it feel like the Bonnie show instead of church, instead of community. And we went with great gusto trying to build community at the beginning, where we have, we have Tuesday Bible study and Zoom fellowship hour, and we were doing online music on Mondays and online music on Wednesdays, and we were trying to do all these things, and everybody was just exhausted. We're trying to, people are working from home and everything's online, and they're getting their kids on school online, and nobody wants to be online come Sunday morning. And so that's been a challenge. It's been really hard, and I totally also don't want to be online either, so I understand that. And at the same time, I feel God calling us to do all these amazing things in our community. But as we're developing those things and working to build those relationships, maybe it's God's way of saying you need to do this really slowly and prayerfully. Which could be a really good thing, but I just wanted, let's get this going. So it's been a challenge to me to slow it down and take time. And my self-care has suffered, definitely.
Yeah.
I feel depleted.
As I recall, seeing the exterior of your church during the Halloween season, haven't you done pumpkin sales in the past?
Yeah.
Are you going to be able to do anything like that this year? And how is that going to, I mean, it seems like to me that could be one of those sacred cows, if you will.
Some
churches do that they don't even realize is so important to them. And do it is like, whoa. How is that working?
There's been a lot of tears on my part for sure about the pumpkin patch. So much so that my old church is still doing a pumpkin patch because they're out in suburbia and they're doing a pumpkin. And I'm going to go help them unload pumpkins on Saturday.
Okay.
Because I love the pumpkin patch. And last year doing the pumpkin patch as my first year here, it was eye-opening to me to have that experience. And I hope that I communicated that with my folks, that this ministry of the pumpkin patch, not only is it an act of outreach because we support First Nations Indian Reservation or First Nations Reservation in New Mexico through that pumpkin patch, but getting to know our neighbors and having so many neighbors say things to me like, I'm so glad this church is here.
Mm-hmm.
Such an important part of the community. But then to be baffled and not know why they think that, because they don't come. They don't come to church. And they don't, you know, they come and bought pumpkins, but I've never seen them since. So what is it about St. Luke, and how can we tap into that identity of being the church in the neighborhood? How do we tap into it so that it is true? Because they said that to me and I thought, I don't think that's true. I don't know how that's true other than the pumpkin patch. Because it's not like we're, you know, we have a Wesley nurse that's stationed here, but this community is not a community that serves a population that is homeless or immigrant or needing healthcare in that way. We don't have a food pantry. We support a food pantry at Trinity United Methodist, but we don't really... I don't know what we really do in this neighborhood that connects us, that roots us in this neighborhood, other than we're a building that takes up a...
Well, I will say one thing. I have voted there in the past, and I find that availability to the community to be a plus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, former pastor, I also heard people say, oh, you know, this is my church. Really? You never come? Like, when is this your church? And it baffled me, but I just finally learned to accept that there's something about the presence, going back to a word you use, something about the presence of the people, the church, the location that is in some way meaningful and comforting to people who don't actually come through the doors. How that is, we'd have to explore with those particular people, but I came to the conclusion that it is.
Well, and I find it really interesting that, because my own nature is to be out in the community, and when I became the pastor here, it wasn't that I just became the pastor of St. Luke, I became a pastor to this neighborhood.
Sure.
And so I have had that experience with neighbors, especially in COVID. You know, there's a neighbor that has a couple times reached out, and as we've encountered one another walking the dogs, have spent an hour talking. She's cried on my shoulder. I've prayed for her and her family with her, but she's not a member at St. Luke, and she doesn't come to St. Luke. But I would hope she might say, that's my pastor. And so trying to just, you know, embody that presence in this community, and then trying to disciple my folks to do the same where they live.
Sure.
Because very few of our members actually live in the neighborhood.
So they come in from other parts of the town?
Cedar Park, Bastrop, Elgin, Georgetown, South Austin, like way South Austin. A lot of them lived here and then were priced out
Sure.
You know, they grew up in this neighborhood and then had to leave.
Yeah. I wanted to go back and touch on one other thing that you brought up a few times, and that's connections with First Nations and in particular the Native American population in New Mexico, you said the Pumpkin Patch mm-hmm. goes to. So you mentioned being a Canadian studies major and so on, and that you had a lot of influence then from First Nations individuals and coursework. How has that translated into living in Austin, Texas? In addition to apparently this, did you start the connection with the group in New Mexico?
Mm-mm.
No, okay.
No, that is the Pumpkin Patch people, that's how I describe them, the Pumpkin Patch people. Uh-huh. That has been a ministry that they've had for over 30 years.
Oh, wow. And it's the proceeds have always gone to...
Mm-hmm, because the reservation grows those pumpkins. It's their primary source of income, and they only sell pumpkins. They only do pumpkins through churches.
Okay.
And it's a really interesting model because, you know, churches sign up to have a pumpkin patch, and we get our truckload of pumpkins, like literally a semi-trailer full of pumpkins. And we don't pay anything for those pumpkins. They come to us for nothing. And every day we record our sales and then we submit a portion. And so, you know, depending on it, we might keep 30% of the sales of the pumpkins uh-huh. and everything else goes back to them. But that's their model. So we don't, it's just a really interesting, beautiful partnership that they've developed with churches.
Well, a different way of doing commerce, if you will. Mm-hmm.
And the church in Cedar Park has been doing that pumpkin patch for over 23 years.
Okay.
So it's a big thing.
Yeah.
I would love to go and go to the pumpkin field. I'd love to go and see that. And,
Well, is that going to be possible sometime?
It could be. Yeah, I think it could be. I think they'd be open to that.
That would be, it seemed like that would be really fulfilling to see it in person.
Yeah, I think so.
Road trip.
I know, to New Mexico.
Road trip. It's not that far.
It's not that far, no. And it's probably a little bit cooler where they're growing pumpkins.
Yeah, yeah.
Similar to Alberta weather, but anyways, yeah.
Wow. Well, Bonnie, let me ask if there's anything else that you would like to share during this time about your congregation, about the pandemic, about your own calling to being a minister that we haven't touched on that you think is important to include in this interview.
The one thing that I'm thinking about in the time of pandemic and in the time of being a pastor and trying to do all this stuff that we are all trying to do is that that idea of slowing down and, you know, I've spoken a lot, I think, about being present as Christ is present in the world, like being Christ's presence in the world. But I've really been reflecting on the fact that I need to reflect more. I need to spend more time noticing that Christ is present with me in this, how do I describe that? There's been a lot more need for self-care and need for reflection and need for prayer. And that's made me realize it's not just a need in this time of pandemic, but always.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to get busy. I tend to get busy with the rush
of
leading a church. And even in this time, I felt that sense of urgency. But God is, I don't know that God operates on a sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. I mean, here it is 2,000 years later, and we're still waiting for the second coming of Christ, right? Like, we're still waiting, but I think God is not urgent. I don't know that God is so urgent. God takes God's time. So I need to learn to take my time and spend time learning from God. don't know. It's just, it's an interesting thing I've been thinking about.
Yeah.
Breathing.
Well, I like, I think I'll be thinking about your comment about urgency. And we are constantly, it seems like with the social media that we have and so on and instantaneous news that everything is urgent. You know, like every day there's something that you must do something now. You must act now. You must, you know, yeah. The urgency is and busyness then that goes with it is so prevalent in our culture that
I think too,
God's urgency might be helpful.
And when we think about urgency in terms of God and in terms of evangelism, I really, that struck me strangely when I moved here was this whole, we have to evangelize, that more evangelical bent. We have to mm-hmm. get the message out so that you can say that prayer, so that you can be saved now. And you know, when Christ invited his disciples to come and follow me, he was inviting them to a journey with him.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, they didn't understand who he was and what he was doing and that he was the Messiah. And sometimes they hoped maybe they were getting the answer right when they said, "You're the Messiah." But I feel like that's a journey it took time. It was about building relationships and I love that idea of, I approached youth ministry like that, where I was just inviting students, like, let's do this faith thing together and see where it leads us. And not that, you know, I needed to make sure that this student said that prayer so that I knew they were saved. I mean, God knows what God's doing in their life and how God is working on their heart. And I'm just supposed to be, like I said, present with them and illuminating a path in a way. So yeah, there's an urgency in the United States and maybe that North American mindset that.
Yeah.
Have you seen that Cadillac commercial from 2014? There's a Cadillac commercial. And now all you have to do is Google 2014 Cadillac commercial and you'll see it. And there's this man purposely striding at a brisk pace through his house. And he's talking about, you know, in America, we work a 60-hour work week and we do this and we do that. And he's passing by his wife and he's passing by his kids as they're playing. And he doesn't really stop to do anything with them. And then so that they can, you know, have this beautiful house and this beautiful wife and these beautiful kids. This is why we work the way we work in America. And I remember seeing that commercial and just being appalled.
Yeah.
Appalled. That.
Yeah.
Sit down and play with those kids on the floor. Like.
Yeah. The acquisition is the goal.
Yeah. And the speed, the pace that he was going through that house at.
Yeah.
I was just like, that's what's matter with this country. That's what's wrong with us all. Living that life.
And I don't want to keep you too much longer, but do you think then that part of the, I guess, dynamics in our country about getting quote unquote back to normal is this dis-ease with being still?
Yeah, I really do.
Yeah. We have to go, go, go. We have to acquire, acquire, acquire. And so therefore we need all these places open and, you know.
And if you don't have a place to go to and you just stay at home and read a book in your backyard, you feel unproductive. And that, I think that has affected our mental health too, that we feel like we're not being productive and we haven't figured out how to rest in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I did an exercise with my youth kids in Cedar Park one time where I invited another person from the church who also, I practice a centering prayer practice. She practices centering prayer. And I invited her to do it with our youth kids, most of who were middle schoolers at the time. That particular year, they were a lot of middle schoolers. And they were able to sit for 20 minutes in silence. And we didn't tell them how long they were going to sit, but our goal was to do a 20-minute practice. And at the end, this grade six student boy said, "That was amazing. I I don't know if I've ever been with myself for 20 minutes.
That's great.
And I think that's, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
If we could just teach that and model that and practice that, we'd be so much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
So.
Bonnie, I'm gonna I guess close our interview just by offering a word of thanks. Thank you for sharing
Thank
so much.
you.
I've learned more about you, and two, just love hearing your perspective on being a minister and pastoring a church in general, and then during this time. I got to tell you, well, I'll go ahead and stop the recording, and like I said, we'll get you a transcript of this so you can review it. Okay.